about all things Messianic Judaism. Each episode, we will be sharing our opinions as we tackle some of the biggest issues in Messianic Judaism. Now, here's your hosts, Rabbis Eric, David, Jonathan, and Toby.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us for another episode of the Messiantics podcast. We are excited to dive into another conversation. This one a bit different, not necessarily a direction we were expecting to go, as at the time of this recording, Rabbi Eric and myself are supposed to be in Israel. We were supposed to fly out on the 14th of April and come back on the 21st of April. Statement, which I've heard other rabbis use, that April to go and to connect with friends and ministry connections that we have in Israel, to hopefully be an encouragement and minister to them and bring blessing to them and such. And unfortunately, if you have not paid attention to the news in the past week or two, unfortunately, Iran decided that they were going to launch an attack at Israel. And it was a multi kind of faceted attack. It was both out of Iranian soil as well as from the Houthis and Hezbollah as proxies of Iran into Israel in response for Israel taking out a couple of IRGC higher ups in an Iranian military base in Syria that they keep purporting on the news as Israel took out an Iranian embassy, but it was not. It was actually an Iranian military base in an area that they shouldn't have been in to begin with. But nonetheless, the Iranian government, the IRGC, launched hundreds of what they were calling suicide attack drones that were never intended to return back to Iranian soil. They launched cruise missiles, and then there were a ton of rockets by Hezbollah and such that were launched and so on into Israeli airspace. And thankfully, there was about 10 hours warning that Israel had, if I remember the numbers correctly, about a 10-hour warning that Israel had of this attack coming. So Israel and their organization, but also locally as an individual congregation, in that we don't have our allies were able to be prepared. We saw a massive response from and others. Now we're getting word that Saudi had some intel involvement in making sure Israel was aware of what was going on and so on. And so Israel was able to defend against, and I think if I remember correctly, it's a 99% defense. They defended against 99% of the rockets and UAVs and such that were coming toward Israel. And as far as I know, only one was severely injured. I believe it was a 10-year-old Bedouin girl was injured in one of the ordnance that hit the surface. So I mean, it was a really rough night overall in Israel. Moving into the 14th of April there. And so Rabbi Eric and I had a pretty substantial conversation on trying to determine what we were going to do, because while this attack is happening, you know, it's here in the States, it's probably about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening. Our flight is the next morning at 6 a.m. out of Pensacola to fly to Miami, and then about 2 p.m. out of Miami to fly to Israel. And we're sitting here 12 hours out from our flight out of Pensacola going, what's going to happen? Are we going to have a flight out? Are we going to have to, are they canceling the flights? Are we going to postpone? What are we going to do? And kind of went back and forth. And I guess it was about 9 o'clock or so Saturday night that we ended up deciding, for precaution's sake, to cancel the trip.
Right, and it wasn't so much that we were, because we had these long discussions, and we had a million text messages and emails and phone calls from people calling us to find out what we were going to do, but our discussion wasn't about are we afraid to go or are we afraid to get hurt while we're there, because the reality is, if it's your time, it's your time. Doesn't matter whether you're on I-10 in Florida or you're in Israel. Our concern was that we would either not be able to get there and be stuck in Miami or trying to find flights back, or we would get to Israel and they will be actually in full-scale war with Iran, and we wouldn't be able to actually do the things we were wanting to do, which was to go visit people and give the donation. You know, in the Bible, Paul said he collected an offering from different cities to bring it to Jerusalem so that they could bless the people there who were struggling and suffering. And Unfortunately, the media isn't talking a lot about the fact that there are thousands and thousands of Israelis that since October 7th had to move out of their homes and are living either in hotels or other people's houses. They're not able to go to their jobs, their work, things like that. So we wanted to be a financial blessing to especially believers in Israel. So we were going over with resources that we had gathered from donations from people to hand directly to while praying for people there. And we were concerned that we would get there, get stuck in a hotel for a week, not be able to accomplish what we went for, and then fly back not being able to complete what we wanted to do.
Yeah. And probably one of the worst things out of it all was waking up on Sunday and seeing that Israel had... let me rephrase. Worst things to us.
Right.
Israel being attacked was pretty bad if you live in Israel. But one of the worst realities to us was when we woke up Sunday morning and we're looking at the news and information. And about 7 hours after closure, Ben-Gurion opens back up. And all flights are for that day are scheduled on time and so on. And we're like, well, did we just mess up? Should we have not made a rush decision? Should we? But the truth of the matter was that in hindsight, it's always easy to look back at stuff and go, oh, well, we could have done this different. But we were looking at it with several factors in hand, those that Rabbi Eric mentioned, but also the fact that, you know, we have family and congregation and stuff here that we are responsible for. And there's a point in time where you've got to factor is it a wise decision to put yourself in a potentially war zone dangerous scenario or not, which honestly I would do in a heartbeat for Israel. Like, I would be there in a heartbeat, but this was a bit of an awkward scenario to try and figure out. But nonetheless, as we talk today, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was, I don't know if you've paid attention to history or not, but this is the first time in the history of Iran as Iran that they've ever launched an attack direct on Israel from their own soil. They've threatened countless times over the decades, but this is the first time in history that Iran launched a direct attack on Israel from their own soil. It's usually them funding proxies like Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis or whoever else, ISIL and so on. But this is the first time they've done it directly out of their own turf, out of their own soil, which is a huge escalation in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, we can look at it and go, and this is something I've said is, you know, it's interesting that they gave 10-hour warning. They launched very slow UAVs. They, like, it was obvious Iran had to be aware that Israel was going to be able to defend against this, and it wasn't going to be a major problem. And I think on one hand, Iran was kind of trying to save face because their military base got hit by Israel. Their IRGC, you know, higher ups got hit and taken out by Israel. By the way, one of which was directly involved in the funding and planning of the October 7th attacks.
And the recent attacks on American soldiers,
yep,
in Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, which is specifically why Israel hit this location, was to get that individual. And so the IRGC attacks, in a manner in which... And I think, and this is just my theory, I think it's likely that they felt they had to do something because they talk a big game. They had to put a stake behind it at some point. But they also really didn't want to get into a mix with Israel in a legitimate way, because I don't know that Iran can hold up to Israel. If Israel really goes after them, I don't know that Iran can hold up. And I definitely know they can't hold up if Israel's allies get involved as well.
Yeah, I can tell you, and I hope Toby will share his perspective on this also, because both David and I were heading to Israel when this happened, mm-hmm, but Toby wasn't in that kind of investment, but dealing with this from, and I don't want, as and we will get into some of the historical or some of the political ramifications of this, but I really want to talk about this from the position of being people of faith, mm-hmm, and because the response that I've seen from believers has been interesting, because, for instance, I've heard people say, you know, Israel should just nuke Iran and kill all of them. And while in my flesh, as a Jew, as one who Israel is my people's homeland, my flesh response would be, yeah, let's just make a parking lot out of it. However, as a believer, and knowing that Iran is currently having one of the largest revivals where Muslim people are coming to faith in Yeshua, and it's moving in from house to house and place to place, there are who knows how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of believers there in Iran that are not connected with. They don't want to destroy Israel. And I actually shared a video on my social media the other day of a young Iranian girl who made it very clear that the Iranian government, the religious government that's ruling and functioning, that it doesn't speak for the Iranian people. And you can watch video after video of Iranian people talking about how much they love the Jewish people and how much they love Israel. So in my heart, there's this tug of war that goes on between wanting to defend your homeland and your people and wanting to deal with that, and at the same time understanding that this is a relatively small group of people that's leading this country, while the vast majority of the people of Iran are not desiring war with Israel. They're not desiring to take Israel out and drive them. It's a different thing. And then on top of that, I was just amazed by the involvement of Saudi and especially Jordan, who actually launched fighters to fight alongside Israel.
Yeah.
Growing up, Jordan was and Saudi were adversaries of Israel. They were, growing up, it was dealing with the Jordanians firing guns, rockets, and weapons and attacking Israel, and now standing alongside Israel, defending them. It just, the mixed feelings of this event, and again, it's so weird because within me are different variants. There's my love for Israel, and which is unequivocal. My love, not that doesn't mean I agree with everything the Israeli government does, but my love for Israel, the land, my love for believers. And there are millions of believers in Iran now. Growing up, the history I had with Jordan and Saudi Arabia and so on, and now sitting there cheering the Jordanian Air Force as they stand alongside, fly alongside, and defend Israel from this attack. It was just a blend of different thoughts and emotions and things going on, which is the vast switches and changes of things that have taken place is really pretty overwhelming.
I saw a video on social media from a content creator who's in the military, the U.S. military, and whatever, but he's comedic. He does some pretty funny stuff. He goes, he said, people keep saying we're living in unprecedented times. He goes, what do you have to do to get to precedented times? Because I'm really tired of seeing everybody at war. I'm really tired of all of these threats. I'm really tired of financial crises. I'm really tired of what do we do to get back to precedented times? And I think that's when I talk about this is the first time Iran's done something like this. You talk about Saudi and Jordan kind of defending Israel and the sort of historical irony of that. It really is. Unprecedented is the only way I can describe it. I don't have another word for it. It's very weird. It's an awkward feeling. I mean, on one hand, you look at it and go, okay, this kind of feels a lot like end time prophecy really starting to boil over. And it might be. And I think in a lot of ways it is. But at the same time, I think every generation since John wrote Revelation felt that it was their time. That their day was the day. And so I don't think we're necessarily special in that sense that, that's not to say it's not. I think we're a lot closer than they were 2,000 years ago, but still. But it definitely has this feel of something bigger. Right. And it's a weird thing. I was talking with a good friend of ours who lives in Israel. He's from the U.S. and made Aliyah, him and his wife and kids. And he goes, In 4 years, I've got two kids in the IDF. Over the next 4 years, I've got two kids that have to go and volunteer to serve as everything's heating up. Joshua Aaron's got his oldest daughter is in the IDF right now, and his oldest son will be joining the IDF in the next couple of months, if not sooner. So it's a very real thing, and lots of other people that we have connections with that have children that are in the military right now. It's a very interesting thing to see as we're watching this play out and how it affects people that we actually know, like that are really close with us, that we've been friends and you know, in essence, family with for years, and watching how it's changing things in a very dramatic way. And I don't know, I mean, my feelings are weird. Like, I agree with you. There's this one side of me that's like, oh, just go wipe them all out. But then the realization that something like 70% of Iran, like, yes, there's a lot of believers in Iran. There's a growing revival in Iran. There's still Jewish people in Iran. There's still a Jewish community in Iran. But it's something like 70 or 80% of the Iranian people do not want the IRGC, do not want the Ayatollahs, do not want the Iranian government to be in charge anymore. They want a regime change. And if you track back to the 60s and 70s, what Iran was then versus what it is now are two entirely different worlds. And you've got a country that is growingly, it's more and more this is happening, that when a female wears a hijab the wrong way, they just get killed in the streets. Somebody does something wrong, they lynch them from a crane in the middle of the public square. You know, it's an absolutely insane environment. And so part of me is like, oh, just, you know, go and wipe everything out. But the other part of me is very much like, hey, there are real lives at stake here that have nothing to do with what the Ayatollah, what the IRGC is doing, that have nothing to do with what is happening there, that need to be in consideration. And beyond that, what about the good news? How do we present that in a way that is a blessing if we're saying go and wipe everything out, go and take everything and be done with it? I think it's definitely a weird situation, a weird feeling to walk into.
Yeah, I find it. Go ahead, Toby.
I wasn't going to Israel when it was happening. I wasn't part of that situation. I don't know. I when things like you know, like this thing with Iran and then of course October 7th, and then I remember back in like 07 when Lebanon that stuff was going on. I try not to get involved with the fear mongering that some people kind of do, which is like, oh, this is it, this is the time when it's all gonna, you know, it's gonna be the end times and this, that, and the other and stuff. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being ready, you know, Yeshua says don't be deceived. But that's what's the interesting thing, you know, when the disciples asked him, you know, how do we know when it's, you know, how do we know when you're about to come back, you know, when it's the end of the age? He doesn't say to get ready. He doesn't tell him to prepare, really. He just says, don't be deceived. Of course, he doesn't tell him to, like, actually, you know, he doesn't give them, like, actual instructions to, like, go here, go there. He's the first thing he says is not to be deceived. So when those things happen, when Israel's attacked and those kinds of things, at this point, it's happened enough times where I'm not trying to sound callous. I'm just not surprised when those nations do that. I think I shouldn't be surprised really at the reaction of our country and things like that oftentimes, because it just seems so bizarre to me how small Israel is compared to the countries around it. And it makes sense. It doesn't make sense to me that people would criticize Jewish people in Israel when there's so many people around the world that have their own homeland. Like Russians have Russia, and you know, the English have England, and Americans have America, and of course America is a melting pot, but Canadians have Canada, and there's all these African countries, and Brazilians have Brazil and things like that. So Jewish people can't have Israel. It boggles my mind. It seems so unfair. Well, it is unfair. It doesn't seem that way. It is. And it's interesting that when you consider world politics and all the geopolitics or whatever, which every country has issues and this, that, and the other, but it should point so many people to the truth of the Bible that this little tiny country that's like so tiny, it's so small, has been the center of so many issues for generations because of what God's doing there and what He said He would do there. So, I mean, I, I, it, it's it's again, I'm not trying to sound callous when I'm like, oh, great, you know, I'm not surprised. It just doesn't surprise me because of what Scripture says Israel would be involved in, that it would be kind of like this, you know, God's timepiece, you know, for the prophetic, you know, implications of what's going to happen in the world and stuff, and where, you know, Yeshua is going to return there. So there's always going to be this heartbeat there, prophetically. I think the first thing, you know, you do is you pray for the peace of Jerusalem. You pray for the peace of, you know, Israel and all those things. The thing is, though, is that when I consider things like, because it is a very helpless feeling, well, especially like for me, like I don't, like at this point, I can't move there. You know, I'd love to live there one day at this point, you know. I would love to do that one day, Lord willing. But and I do have friends that live there and stuff. But when I think about, it's a really helpless feeling, I think, especially in our position. I know when October 7th happened, I was on vacation with my wife, and that was awful. Like, I wanted to go home, and I wanted to go over to Israel and, you know, see if they would let me join the IDF and stuff. You have this moment of, like, really, you know, but it's like, it's a very helpless feeling. So what do? You just have to do the spiritual warfare, you know. So you pray and stuff. But I think that was how I felt. When Iran did that, it did feel different. When October 7th happened, it was just, I was enraged and again, felt helpless. When Iran did that, it felt like it was kind of a show, because it was but it was also kind of like, man, okay, so if this is Iran getting involved, then we'll get involved in this, that, and the other. And so, you know, I don't know, you know, I hope I'm making a point. No, my take on it was, you know, when you're in the messianic movement, because the church is so oblivious to a lot of it. Sometimes I think for some Christians, I think they just think Israel's another, well, you know, Israel's just another country. But being messianic, you're always tuned into what's going on there. So when something like Iran happens, or when October 7 happens, you know, and it hits you really hard, but then it's also like, but golly, you know, the Bible said this stuff would happen. So I think that's the toughest thing, is feeling like there's something we need to do, and there's something you want to do, but then you know kind of like how terrible it's going to get right before it gets, you know, right before the Lord returns. Yeah. And stuff. So, yeah. I don't
know. Yeah, it's crazy. So I want to say this. First and foremost, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast over the period of time that it's been in existence about replacement theology and dispensationalism and so on. And I want to reiterate, I said this last night at our Bible study. I said this a couple of weeks ago at a Passover Seder that Rabbi Toby and I did for a church in the area. Look, there are so many Christians, so many in the church that believe that at the cross, God was done with the Jewish people, that all of the blessings and promises and covenant to Israel, to the Jewish people, has somehow been spiritually transferred to the Gentile church, and that he doesn't care about the Jewish people anymore. And it's a very problematic issue to begin with, and I think that's a lot of why we have so much anti-Semitism in the church today. I think that's why we have so many people in the church today that are, and now there's a lot of Christians, a lot of churches that are very pro-Israel, very supportive, but there's also a lot of voices that are very anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, that are very much pro, and I'll never understand how we have people, especially here in America, that are pro-Hamas in this mix. Not pro-Palestinian, they're pro-Hamas, because they just hate the Jewish people. But here's the thing about it. If you're a believer in Yeshua, if you believe that Jesus is the promised Messiah of Israel, if you believe that Jesus is the only means of salvation, and that your faith in Jesus gives you eternal salvation, you cannot truly actually believe that your salvation is eternal if you do not believe that God's covenants and promises to Israel and the Jewish people are eternal. If you believe that in any way, shape, fashion, or form, God could have stopped or ended or cut off Israel from his eternal covenant, he says in his word that his relationship, his covenant, his promises to Israel is eternal. And if you believe that he could somehow flip the switch on eternal when it comes to that, then you can't possibly truly believe that God can hold his word and truly means that your salvation is eternal. Because if you believe he could flip the switch on one, what makes you think he can't or won't flip the switch on the other? So in order for us to believe that our salvation in Yeshua is eternal, we have to equally and also believe wholeheartedly that God's covenantal promises to Israel are eternal. And so there is a biblical, a spiritual obligation for us to, as believers, to stand with Israel in the midst of this. That's not to say that we have to think that Israel does everything perfect. Israel is not a perfect country by any means. Israel is not a hyper-religious country by any means. There are hyper-religious people there, but it is not a hyper-religious country by any means. It is a predominantly, overwhelmingly predominantly secular country. And aside from that, it's the only legitimate democracy in the Middle East. It is the only democracy in the Middle East that has freedom, like legitimate freedom. You can be a Christian and be in Israel and be okay. You can be a Muslim in Israel and be okay. You can be Hindu. You can be Buddhist. You can be Baha'i, you can be whatever, and it's all okay. You're not going to have issues. But you can't say the same for the countries that surround Israel, right? If you go to Lebanon or to Syria or to Iran or to Iraq and you're a Christian or you're a Jewish person, you're in trouble. It's not going to be a safe environment for you. There are laws against your existence there. But in Israel, you can stand firm.
Right. It's interesting, and we've been watching the news and all this stuff going on, but one of the things that both Rabbi Toby said and Rabbi David said is talking about this concept of Christians separating themselves from Israel as if Israel is other from them. When the scripture says if you are a non-Jewish person who is a believer in Yeshua, you become grafted into and you become part of the mm-hmm. commonwealth of Israel. And it's one of those things where when you realize that, it's kind of like when we moved to Alabama and suddenly there was, you know, Alabama or Auburn. Which team were you on? Which team did you root for? And everybody, it didn't matter if you ever attended Alabama. It didn't matter if once you became a fan of Alabama, you were part of that team, regardless of what school you went to, what state you were from, what country you were from. And if you understand that when you become a believer in Yeshua, you become part of the Commonwealth of Israel, then there should be no way you could root for the other team. You could stand up against Israel because the covenant promises that God made to Abraham. If you remember, when God established his covenant with Abraham, Abraham was asleep. And God made that covenant with Abraham. It's a one-sided covenant that God said, I'm going to do. There is no responsibility on Israel to keep that covenant that God said he would always keep. The other side of this is that we need, you know, we're listening to, for instance, Tucker Carlson did a program recently where he was talking about the Christians that used to be in Bethlehem and how Israel has affected them and not genocide, but driven them away and all. But if you actually know what happened, Bethlehem was 80% Christian until Bethlehem was given over to the Palestinian Authority to rule. And it was the Muslims that ran the Christians out, and they became part of Greater Israel. They didn't like go away. They moved out of Bethlehem into the Jewish sections of Israel and became part of the community there where Muslims, Christians, Druze, and others all have equal rights within the citizenship. So it's not that the Jews were horribly mean to these Christians in Bethlehem. It's that the Muslims chased the believers out, the Christians out of Bethlehem. And so we hear these things, and then the result of people reporting things like that is people who proclaim to have faith in the Messiah of Israel standing out on bridges and in roads waving Hezbollah and Hamas flags and proclaiming that their faith in Yeshua, the Messiah of Israel, is the reason they have to stand with the terrorists in their actions. It's just bizarre. And Toby also was talking about the size of Israel. Israel has just under 10 million people that are citizens, that are part of Israel. Iran has 88 million people that live there. Iran is 10 times. It's the actual David versus Goliath scenario that we're seeing. And Goliath attacked Israel, and David used the David sling to defend against Goliath. And the small nation of Israel once again wins. Now, I want to say I don't believe, you can believe if you want, that it was the superiority of Israel's military and the superiority of the U.S. military and the superiority of the Jordanian military and the superiority of France and England. But I believe that this was the superiority of God. Yep. And that God brought, and even military experts in Israel have written papers on already on the fact that no unified military. You can't get British Air, French Air, Jordanian Air, Israeli Air Force, and American Air Force all fighting together instantly because they didn't like practice this and have them all work in such chorus together to stop this attack. This is clearly a supernatural move of God that stopped those missiles. Now, he used, just like David used a sling and a rock to take down Goliath, God used the military, the weaponry of Israel and her allies to take down those rockets. But you can't look at it and not see that there wasn't a supernatural event that took out those 100%. Rockets.
And I'm going to add a little something extra to that now that you brought up David and Goliath in the mix. Here's the interesting thing about all of this. When we talk about the Israel-Arab conflict, and we'll expand it out, the Israel-Arab conflict or the Jewish-Islamic conflict or however you want to look at it, the reality is this goes way farther back than 612 Common Era when Muhammad started preaching his vision and the Quran began to develop in the 700s and so on. Like, it goes way before all of that because the reality is this Israeli-Arab conflict is actually a age-old, millennia-old family conflict. This goes all the way back to Isaac and Ishmael and to Jacob and Esau. Esau married Ishmael's daughters to make his parents mad, and it's loosely from that train that we end up getting the Arab people as a whole. And it's a family conflict that goes back to Isaac and Ishmael having their issues and Esau and Jacob having their issues and never actually dealing with those issues. And then we go even further into Joshua, and we see that when Joshua leads Israel into the promised land, that they stop short of taking the area of Gaza from the Philistines. And the Philistines grow there and become a constant thorn in Israel's side because they stopped short of actually fully taking that land. And they never did what they were supposed to. In fact, it was Dan that rejected it and walked away from it and went north. But the reality is Israel never fully took that land. And so the Philistines ended up settling and developing and growing there. And from Gaza continued to be a massive issue for Israel throughout their history, right? And then we continue to go out. So October 7th, and this Gaza-Israeli conflict isn't new, but October 7th was a reiteration of this historical conflict. It's not the same people by any means, because the Philistines don't exist anymore. The name Palestinian is just some bogus name they picked out to tug at the heartstrings of the UN and Western people and whatever.
And it's important that I'm interrupting. I know, but I apologize, but I'm going to say it anyhow. The word Philistine means invader. It's the actual word means invader. So here we have the original Philistines who were invaders into the land that weren't driven out. And now because of the Romans calling the region Palestinia, we have the rebirth of the name Philistine. And then with Yasser Arafat, we have him proclaiming to be, he was an Egyptian, but proclaimed to be a Palestinian so that he could invent a home people or a people that supposedly
called this area home.
Right, called the area home and it was their ancestral homeland.
Indigenous, they
say. Which is not at all true. Now, that doesn't mean that the Arab people haven't been living in and around Israel all this time. But it's important that we understand the truth of these things.
And so we see this same issue. Israel never fully conquered Gaza. They never took care of that situation back in Joshua's day, never took care of it all the way through David and Solomon and so on. And it's still the same exact issue. It's a spiritual, generational spiritual problem. At the same sense, Iran attacking Israel is nothing new either. The country Iran hasn't existed forever by any means. But do you know what an Iranian Christian calls themselves? A Persian, because they don't like to be associated with Iran, with the Iranian regime, with the IRGC, with the Ayatollahs. The Persian Empire was at the heart of the story of Esther. Right, we have Haman, who was a Persian high-ranking official. Haman was trying to slaughter the Jewish people and wipe them off the face of the earth. And yet, here again, the Iranian government, the Persian, this Persian version of this Islamic jihadi rogue nation, is trying to yet again wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And so what we see is historically these spiritual generational things keep coming back around again. And so this conflict between Israel and the Arabs is nothing. It's nothing new. I mean, it's something that has been lingering since biblical times and continues to fester. But ultimately, we know that it brings about the scenario that ushers in the return of Messiah in the long run. And so while on one hand, there's this heartbreaking, heart-wrenching reality to what we're seeing, I talked with another friend of mine, Jonathan Moore, who lives in the Jerusalem area, right after October 7th occurred. And we were chatting. He goes, look, if you can express anything to your friends in the church in the States, he said, if you can express anything, it's this. They need to understand that while the body of Messiah tends to have this notion that Messiah is coming back as the same pacifist, as the same innocent lamb being willing to be led to the slaughter, laying his life down, like we have this notion of this sacrificial Yeshua that's coming back again, like he's going to do it all over again. So, but you got to understand, the Bible tells us that when he comes back, like that was a once and done thing. He died for our sins. He passively laid his life down for our sins willingly, right? He's only doing that once. When he comes back, the Bible tells us he's coming back as a warlord. He's coming back as a warrior king prepared to lead his people into eternal victory against the forces of death and darkness. And so we need to stop praying for this, pacifist concept of God bringing peace to the region. I mean, there needs to be peace to the region, yes, but we need to pray for people to put their faith in Yeshua as their Messiah, because he is coming back as that warrior king, and we need to understand that we need to have a heart like what he's coming back with. Like, we need to have this understanding of who he's coming for and not be afraid of the fact that, yes, war and horrible things are a part of what's got to happen in advance of it. Scripture tells us terrible things are going to play out in advance of Messiah's return, and we've got to be aware, alert, and ready. And this is just a part of that. It's not comfortable. It's not awesome, but it is a part of that.
I think the problem with as far as, because both of you have talked about how Christians view it.
Yeah.
I know there's some that support Israel, and I know that there's some that are probably indifferent, that are just like, oh, that's really bad over there. I'm shocked that there would be any Christians that would support Hamas or anything like that. It's amazing to me. I think the problem, though, is that, and again, this is why Messianic Judaism is better than Christianity. Understand that Messianic Judaism considers itself part of the body of Messiah, which, you know, most Christians call the church. That when they refer to the church, they're talking about all the believers in Yeshua and Jesus. The Messianic movement considers itself part of that body. The thing is, though, is that why I think Messianic Judaism is important, and I think, I guess I certainly see it as an advantage and a strength, but here's the problem. I think if you find a garden variety Christian who goes to church on Sunday and does Christmas and Easter and all those things. And they love Jesus, and they believe in Jesus, and they believe he died on the cross and all those things. I would love to ask them, like, so, where's Jesus from? He's from Israel. What was his race? Well, he was Jewish. But I guarantee you, I think there are a lot of Christians out there, I think far too many, that if you ask them, why is that important that he's from Israel? Why is that important that he's Jewish? I think there would be some that wouldn't know how to answer that question. Because much of Christianity is they take the salvation part, which is the most important thing, but they throw away who he actually was as far as his identity. What I think it's so important to ask the question, what is God like? Like, what is he like? What is his personality? What is his character? What was Yeshua like? Because, and I get when Christians say things like, it's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. And I'm like, what was he all about? He wept over Jerusalem. He told them specifically, he told the Jewish leadership specifically that he was not going to come back until they acknowledged him. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's the problem. All that to say, I think that's the problem with Christianity is just that they receive the salvation part, and that's what they mean. When I hear a Christian say it's all about Jesus, I'm like, I know what you're saying. You're saying that's what you need to have eternal life. That's a ridiculous small box to put him in. It's all about Jesus. I'm like, all that means is he's your requirement. He's the ticket you need. You have no interest in, or at least you act like you have no interest in, what he did on a day-to-day basis, what he cared about, what was important to him, and what was and what Yeshua is all about is he's all about Israel and stuff. It's like I think that so many people think, you know, when he comes back, he's going to come back to like New York or something. Anyway, yeah. So yeah.
I want to say a couple of things real quick. One is I mentioned earlier that Rabbi David and I were heading to Israel to distribute some funds and finances that we had raised to give to people there. I want to let everybody know that even though we didn't fly to Israel, the funds have been sent to Israel and were sent to individual believers there so that it could be a blessing to them. So the finance is already there. Matter of fact, one of the people that we sent funds to had just finished his 6 months down in Gaza and returned, and we're getting ready to take his family away for a week just to kind of decompress and everything. And they were unbelievably grateful for the gift that we gave because it made that trip
possible
for them to be able to go and do.
Or at least easier.
Right, easier. Yeah, so I want to make sure everybody knows all the funds that were given mm-hmm. have been distributed, or just about. There's two more people that have to get, but we're just waiting on their transfer information to get here. The other thing I wanted to say is by the time you hear this, because this is pre-recorded, Israel may or may not have responded or retaliated to the Iranian attack. At the moment we're recording this, Israel has not yet responded militarily. I don't know if they will or not, but I want to encourage all of you listening, and if they do respond or they don't respond, it doesn't change what I'm about to say, and that is that we need to be praying for both the Israeli people, which includes not just the Jews, but the Arabs, the Christians, the Druze, all those who live in Israel. And we need to be praying for Iran and the people there and the people in Jordan and Syria and other places that will be impacted if this becomes a greater conflict. Now, I pray that it doesn't become a greater conflict, but I do want people to understand that our hearts are for the souls of all the people in mm-hmm. the region. We don't just pray for the Israeli people. We pray for all people, go into all the world mm-hmm. and make disciples. So while we love the nation Israel because God loved the nation Israel, the land of Israel, we don't love it opposed to loving everyone else. God chose the Jewish people so that through him he could choose the rest of the world, so that they would bring the message to the rest of the world yep. because he loved all people.
Yep.
So as we're getting ready to wrap up this episode, I wanted to make sure it was clear first that we gave that money out. We have two more people. We're waiting on contact information at this moment, and by the time you hear this, it will have been given out. And then we want you to be joining us to pray for all of the people in the region, including the United States, because the truth is that Iran is not just threatening Israel. They're also threatening the United States.
Yeah. And we will be rescheduling this trip, hopefully, in the coming weeks. We're kind of watching and waiting to see what response and various volleying comes out of this attack this weekend. But we are planning on still rescheduling this trip, getting over and being able to be the hands and feet of Mashiach to our Israeli brothers and sisters.
And two other things real quick. One is I just looked at your watch and there's a friend from Israel that's texting you right at this moment. But the other thing is that in February, we'll be going to Israel and bringing a group with us. And if you would like information on how you can join us on that trip, you can email either me or Rabbi David, and we'll provide that information to you. So we're wanting you to come with us if you're able to and make the a trip to Israel to see the land for yourself. And whether you're Jewish or non-Jewish, if you're a believer in Yeshua, your heart has roots in that land, and every word of the Bible that we have is based upon that land, and it will come to life before your very eyes as you walk across the land. So you can email us or Facebook message us to get to there. Emailing us is not through Messiantics, but you'll email through Rabbi, what's your Rabbi at?
Rabbi at Shalom. Rabbi at ShalomEasternShore.com. As I idiotically drop my phone on the table, but Rabbi at ShalomEasternShore.com.
And then for me, Rav Eric at BritAhm.org. That's BritAhm.org. And we'll send you information on the upcoming trip.
Just for clarification, BritAhm.
Yeah, AHM, not HAM. AHM. And watch your computer as you type that, because it might auto-correct it to Brit Ham. It's not Brit Ham, it's Brit Am. Covenant people.
And thanks for joining us today. We will see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Messiantics Podcast. Make sure to subscribe so you can be notified every time we drop a new episode. And be sure to follow and interact with us on social media at Messiantics Podcast.